Welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, we bring you a lecture by distinguished drama critic, author, and playwright John Lahr. Mr. Lahr's lecture is entitled Comedy and Revenge and touches on Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, Roseanne, Woody Allen, and father Burt Lahr. John Lahr has been senior drama critic for The New Yorker magazine since 1992. His 19 published books include biographies of such notables as Frank Sinatra, Noel Coward, and father Burt Lahr. He is currently engaged in writing the authorized biography of Tennessee Williams. Introducing Mr. Lahr is William D. Adams, president of the Friends of the Libraries of Boston University. President Adams.
Our speaker tonight is John Lahr, the distinguished senior drama critic for the New Yorker magazine. He is a novelist, a biographer, an essayist, and a playwright. In an extraordinary literary career, Mr. Lahr has produced major works on his father, Burt Lahr, Frank Sinatra, Noel Coward, Joe Orton, and Kenneth Tynan. Currently, he is engaged in writing the authorized life of Tennessee Williams. A graduate of Yale and Oxford, here tonight to speak on comedy and revenge, Mr. John Lahr.
Thank you. When you grow up in the home, the household of a great star, great comedian, certain privileges accrue. You get to walk Buster Keaton's ukulele to the train station. You get to pick up Groucho from the hotel room. And your godfather is Eddie Foy Jr. of the Seven Little Foys, who, when his wife told him she was leaving him, nailed all her clothes to the floor. So you learn from a very early age that comedians, or great comedians, really are nothing like what you read in books, or indeed what you read in reviews. Their essence is much murkier, much more panic-struck, much more infantile, and much more murderous. And the conundrum is that out of all these extraordinary negatives, they make joy. And a lot of my writing life has been to try and to change the language and the angle on which theatricals are seen, to bring something of the real confusions and outrageousness that gives us a sense of our moment, a sense of our time. My father, Keaton and Marx, were born in 1895. Chaplin was born in 1889. W.C. Fields was born in 1880. In other words, they grew up with the new century, and they reflected it, epitomized it. How? Well, they were metaphors of action. They personified the will to do. They were kind of go-getters on holiday. America had changed, and they reflected it. Here's a song. A Yankee with know-how don't want to go slow now, so kiss me and run, kid. It's 1901, kid. That's called 20th Century Love, and it's by George M. Cohan. America had changed, and changed in a very dramatic way. And comedy is one of the ways that one of the best barometers of understanding the ever-changing mutations of consciousness of a time. And the best example I know, the best description of that change, is in Henry Adams' autobiography, 1905. He wrote, "Power seemed to have outgrown its servitude and to have asserted its freedom. The cylinder had exploded and thrown great masses of stone and steam against the sky. Prosperity never before imagined, power never reached by anything but a meteor, had made the world irritable, nervous, querulous, unreasonable, and afraid. All New York was demanding new men, and all the new forces condensed into corporations were demanding a new kind of man, a man with 10 times the endurance, energy, will, and mind of the old type, for whom they were willing to pay millions on first sight. Action, speed, money, insecurity, resilience. The new rhythm of the new century demanded a new kind of laughter. And the clowns, the early clowns, the people I'm talking about, were the first simulacrums of this new man, a kind of parody of corporate man. It's interesting to note, for instance, that by 1917, Charlie Chaplin was earning $617,000 a year. Now, the clowns really were metaphors of this new momentum, but with a difference. They were metaphors of dynamism and panic. This panic took the form of the pratfall. You know, the clowns bounding into walls and being knocked down and bouncing back and just rebounding from every obstacle. Dazed but resilient. What a perfect personification of what Veblen called the fearsome and feverish credulity of Americans. Max Sennett revved up the chases, the famous chases, exaggerated the real Western mobility to make it funny. The rhythm of those chases would rev up the old Western rhythm to the speed of the new combustion engine. Clowns turn momentum into fun. Here's Chaplin on his first visit to America in 1910. I was alien to the slick tempo. In New York, even the owner of the smallest enterprise acts with alacrity. The shoeblack flips his polishing rag with alacrity. The bartender serves a beer with alacrity, sliding it up to you along the polished surface of the bar. The soda jerk, when serving an egg malted milk, performs like a hopped up juggler. Clowns carried this momentum to extremes. They were victims and visionaries of momentum, and they showed the truth of momentum, which is that at a certain speed, all things disintegrate. They saw this disintegration all around them, and they registered it. Now, one of the things that I pondered a lot about is what drives someone to make a fool of themselves in public. Yes, you can say money, hunger, attention, mischief, but as the title of this talk indicates, that doesn't seem to me the bottom line. The bottom line is much more infantile, and to me, it is revenge. The people that we're talking about here are big stars, people who cast their shadow over more or less a century, people that if you shut your eyes, you have an iconic image of. Now, stars are two things. They are representatives to us of perfect individuality, but they also personify vindictive triumph. They set the standards of comparison in a competitive society, and they always, whether now or then, every time you turn on your television, you are being told, whether they are telling you directly or not, the great distance between themselves and you, which is part of the drama of celebrity. Dame Edna, I don't know if you know who that is, Dame Edna Everidge, have some of you seen her act? Yes, good, because I wrote a book about her. You'll be hearing more about her this evening. She will return. But Dame Edna has a song in which it's a wonderful parody of fame, the character. She is a housewife superstar, and she sings in one of her acts about her public, and she sings, "You can keep Roman Polanski and Bianca. It's for the companies of nobodies like you I hanker." There again, in that song, dramatizing the thing that individualism actually means in its derivation, which is separation, separate, and dramatizing that separateness. Now, stars are sort of performing workhorses that prove that the system works. And these early stars were like little mini microcosms of capitalism. They were, and they still are. Now they're multinational corporations of one. Then they were just corporations of one. But they worked on the same system of profit. They found a formula, and they repeated it. And the vaudeville circuit was a perfect paradigm of labor following a market. These performers, my father, went out on the road 48 weeks a year, playing five times a day, shifting towns three times a week. A grueling regimen. But what's interesting about these people who are taken to represent the glory of the system, the little men who made good, is that they were all losers in the land of plenty. Desperation fed their energy and their urgency that they brought on stage. They had nothing else but themselves. So what oppressed them? English. Most of them were foreign-born, poor, no status. Field was a petty thief. They were, as I say, they had no economic security. They couldn't compete. They were restless. They had no education. Buster Keaton had one day of schooling. Chaplin, till the end of his life, learned a word a day. My father used to work the crossword puzzles with a big dictionary by his side, just building a vocabulary. They were punished by the possibility of being told they were equal, but having no way to achieve it. They became their own capital. They mocked the sources that oppressed them. The first thing that oppressed them was a lot of them, not all, but a lot, were physically unattractive. When I asked, I spent 5 years writing a book about my father, Notes on a Cowardly Lion. And I asked him one day why he went into show business, and he thought for a minute, and he said, clowns can't lie, not genius ones. He said, I wanted to put my arms around a girl. Told you a lot. W.C. Fields, I don't know if you've ever seen the footage of him juggling. He could juggle a real solitary activity. He could juggle 25 cigar boxes. And he, the same skin ailment that pocked his nose pocked his hands, and he did all that juggling with white gloves on, humiliated by his hands. Comedy, like American life, is about conquest. And the antics of these clowns acted out the infantile wish to get even and to prevail. And if you doubt me, if you think this is just the senior drama critic of The New Yorker floating a little sort of folderol, let me remind you that the language that the comedians use for their success is the language of annihilation. I killed him. I slaughtered him. I knocked him dead. I murdered him. Nietzsche says, one does not kill by anger, but by gravity. Sorry, got to do that again. Nietzsche says, one does not kill by anger, but by laughter. Come, let us kill the spirit of gravity. Now, gravity is everything that weighs us down. And the clowns literally and figuratively defied gravity. How was this aggression expressed? Well, first and foremost, in the beginning of the century, rather like rock groups today, there were kid acts in burlesque where the vicious teacher was gulled by the sort of feckless students who take over the class and humiliate and banish the teacher, which made up for all these performers' offstage failures. They couldn't also, as I've reminded you, speak English very well. And the malaprop became a big part of humor. Pass me the salt if I'm not too inquisitive. The culture that they moved in, their predicaments, was very violent. And some of the acts actually acted out this violence on stage, most memorably The Three Keatons, which Buster joined at the age of one, dressed as a clone of his father, the abusive and drunken Joe and his mother, Myra. Now, Keaton was billed as the living mop, and the family literally wiped the floor with him. Here's an ad for the act. Maybe you thought you were handled roughly when you were a kid. Watch the way they handled Buster. The act elevated child abuse to an art form. Very often when Keaton went into towns, he was forced to strip in front of the police to show that he had no bruises. And the father promoted the idea of him as a midget. In one evening at Yale, I went to Yale, and so I know the sort of tone of the undergraduates. There were some undergraduates cutting up in the front rows, and the father threw Buster at the audience, breaking the arms of a couple of the offending students and knocking Buster out for 18 hours. Now, the origins of his iconic stoicism, that stone face, was literally beaten into him on stage. Here's Keaton. In the Knockabout Act, my father and I used to hit each other with brooms, occasioning from me strange flops and falls. If I should chance to smile, the next hit would be a good deal harder. All the parental correction I ever received was with an audience looking on. I could never even whimper. As he grew older, and the father's reliance on booze got stronger, the fighting on stage was for real. This is Keaton. Mad most of the time. When I smelled whiskey across the stage, I got braced, I got sore, and we'd start trading. Interesting. So what was his revenge? Well, in 1917, the act was asked to go on the passing show of 1917, which is a big deal, for $250 a week. Big money, big time. And Keaton chose to walk away from $250 a week to work with his friend Fatty Arbuckle for $40 a week in what his father called those terrible movies. So Keaton's revenge on his father was to go into the movies and put his father out of work, because without Keaton, there was no act. Same thing with Chaplin. English workhouse, poverty, kissed for the first time by his father when he was 11, put his mother in an insane asylum at the age of 14, had a failure as a performer, in England, sets off to America, quote, a new beginning in a new land. What did he find? Here's what he found. The American is an optimist, preoccupied with hustling dreams, an indefatigable trier. He hopes to make a quick killing, hit the jackpot, get out from under, sell out, make the dough and run, get into another racket. Yet, the incorporate attitude began to brighten my spirit. As a result of our failure, I began to feel light and unhampered. There were many other opportunities in America. Why should I stick to show business? I was not dedicated to art. Get into another racket. I began to regain my confidence. Now, what Charlie's Tramp caught was the quality in America of anxiety and expectation. Protean, ruthless, what de Tocqueville calls restless in the face of abundance. And when you hear this, and when you hear Chaplin describing who Charlie was, he called him a tramp, a gentleman, a poet, a dreamer, a lonely fellow always hopeful of romance and adventure. He would have you believe he's a duke, a scientist, a musician, a polo player. However, he's not above picking up a cigarette butt or robbing a baby of his candy. And of course, he's not above kicking a lady in the rear. Now, the clowns used their personalities, which weighed them down in life, to comic advantage. And through these personas, they admitted themselves. Marx and Fields were misanthropic and isolated. My father was panicked, obsessive, spooked. Chaplin was vicious and lonely and mercurial. But in these personas, they turned themselves and the objects that they worked with on stage inside out. They transformed themselves. And that prowess of transformation, leads inevitably, and I think rather nicely, to them as the clowns as tricksters, and to the notion, which is very important to the notion of revenge, phallic fun. Now, you all, if I ask you to imagine Shakespeare, or the Shakespeare's clown, see the cap and bells. And you also see them, you imagine him with a staff in his hand, yeah? Now, that staff was originally called a bauble or plaything, and it is nothing more or less than a penis. And that penis was a symbol of comic attack, the impulse of comic hijinks, which is to put it to it, to goose an audience, to put it to them, to take them for a tumble. It's amoral, it's rapacious, it's an enemy of boundaries, and it's unrelenting. If you look at the clowns that we know, you'll notice certain phallic vestiges that inevitably show up because the comic impulse always finds these things. But you've got Groucho's cigar, Harpo's horn, Chaplin and Mr. Yulo's Bobby Clark's cane, which would take a trip, poke, prod the world. Phallic fun is part of great comedy. I wrote a book, which was later made into a movie. The book was called Prick Up Your Ears. It was Orton's title. It's about Joe Orton, this wonderful English playwright who was murdered in the 60s. And the film, which I recommend to you because it's a very good film, was with Vanessa Redgrave and Gary Oldman, directed by Stephen Frears. But Prick Up Your Ears was the title of the play he was writing when he was murdered. I don't need to, for those of you who are interested in wordplay, there are many puns in the word prick up your ears. I'll leave it to you to do that if you get bored with what I'm saying. But the title is apt for the comic attack, and it's very interesting that in his great play, What the Butler Saw, which is a farce, a wonderful farce, that reinvents farce for our moment with blood in it, with pain, there is, it all centers around the missing part of Sir Winston Churchill, recently invoked here. And at the end of the play, somebody comes down through a skylight, a policeman comes down through a skylight with a box in his hand, and the two characters on stage, one a psychiatrist and one the perky ingenue, look at this man, and the box is open, and they look in it, and the psychiatrist says, looking into the box, how much more inspiring if in those dark days we'd seen what we see now, the symbol falling far short of the object itself. And the ingenue looks in the box and says, but it is a cigar. And the psychiatrist counters, ah, the illusions of youth. And then the stage direction calls for the penis to be waved at the finale or over the stage. As instinctively, this is exactly right for the spirit of anarchy that Orton was planning on his audience. And you'll hear more about that. Mr. Orton will come back. But when Orton was writing this play, before it went on, his lover, the man who killed him, was reading to him about the living theater, which we all know about, and all the hijinks that went on in the 60s on stage. And Orton made a mental note to hot up What the Butler Saw. And this sentence, which was in his diary, is why I spent 7 years writing a book about him. Now, prepare yourself. This is one of the two or three bits of rudery that you'll hear tonight. Orton said, much more f***, and they'll be screaming hysterics in next to no time. When I read that, I heard the voice of a real clown, a real comedian, because what Orton wanted to do was drive an audience crazy. He wanted to make them terrified and elated and just move them in that way. That issue of terror and elation is something that all great comedians have. You see it in Dame Edna. Now, have many of you seen Dame Edna? Yes, a lot. Well, some of you have. It's a character, housewife superstar, created by Barry Humphreys, and he calls an Australian and a dandy, about whom I've written a book called Dame Edna Everidge and the Rise of Western Civilization. And it's a wonderful character. He calls her a clown in the form of an Australian housewife. And her counterpart, the act that opens for Dame Edna, because they usually come in two, not here, which is why he was probably a success when he came to Broadway, is Sir Les Paterson, the Australian cultural attaché, who is drunk, who comes out with a glass in his hand and says, and spits at the audience, saying, drinking, he says, permit me if I may, showers in. But he's like, he's terrible. He's a shock and an affront to bourgeois taste. And when I was interviewing Barry, as he was getting into this costume, which he tops off by putting Worcestershire sauce on his shirt so that the smell keeps him in character, he was strapping on, which I have to tell you, was about an 8-foot phallus. He just sitting there talking, we're talking about his collection of art, which is a symbolist art, and he was walking around like I am, except he was in his shorts, and he was wearing a 6-foot phallus, which when he's on stage, you can see it sort of sticks up underneath his trousers, and he's always referring to his enormous incumbency. And this shocks, this priapic thing is part of what Barry is up to. And in the second act, on comes Dame Edna, who claims to hate Sir Les. And nonetheless, at the end of her act, those of you who've seen it, it ends with her throwing the Australian national flower up into the audience in the first rows and up into the stalls. And of course, it is the gladiola. So he then makes the audience stand and wave the gladiola. So what you have, if you are watching in the audience, or indeed, as I was from the wings, is you have he completely infantilizes the audience until you have adults in the entire first 5 rows standing in unison, waving. So you're facing a sea of phallic symbols, is what you're facing. And Dame Edna stands back and sort of very refined says, there's nothing more holy than masked gladioli. And at the end of one of her shows, by the way, indicate again this spirit that we're talking about. One show was called Back with a Vengeance. The show that I'm talking to you about now was called An Evening's Intercourse with Dame Edna Everidge. And when the show concluded, that you know how the phony thing that singers do, thank you, you were wonderful, and all that as to get off. She sang this. She sang, I've felt a strong vibration, like a supernatural force. Would I be mistaken? Or have we had a kind of intercourse? And of course they have. He has rumbled them, taken them for a tumble, taken all sorts of liberties with them. Now, when we're talking about transgression, which is what great comedy is about, at this point in when I've given this talk, sometimes people will put up their hands and say, yeah, you've been talking just about men. What about women? And the reality is that times have changed for women in this culture, and also comedy has. And the person who most epitomizes this for me is Roseanne, who I wrote a profile about in The New Yorker. And I want to read, I on the whole don't read, I'm not going to read tonight, but I just want to read you this passage because I can't top in conversation this, but I think it sort of personifies the spirit. Roseanne is a very odd woman, as you well know, but when I got her on the subject of what we're talking about tonight and phallic fun, she suddenly I knew that my instinct was that she was part of this whole issue, and it completely opened her up, and we really had a communication, and this is what she said. Anyway, part of what she said is in this. Rage is Roseanne's ozone. She exudes it. She creates it. It isn't a choice, Roseanne says. You don't decide I'm going to be offensive or do something that upsets people. It just happens. When Roseanne addressed the National Association of College Broadcasters not long ago, she began by saying, some of you have absolutely no talent and don't know what you're doing at all, have no point of view and don't care. I predict that you are the ones who will be successful. The broadcasting wannabes laughed. Roseanne, as usual, was making the unacceptable irresistible. Because of the sexual politics of previous eras, the comedians to whom Roseanne sees herself linked, Mae West, Judy Holliday, Lucille Ball, got their way by cunning indirection. But Roseanne prefers the headbutt to the bon mot. She can rumble. Matt Barry, a stand-up comedian who performed with Roseanne in the Denver clubs and now works as a writer on her show, remembers the time that 50 bikers and their girlfriends came to a gig. She used to have a line in her act where she goes, "I really hate bikers. You know, they all got tobacco juice in their beards, they piss on the side of the road, and the men are even worse." She walks out, sees all these bikers, big burly guys. She looks at the comics in the back. "Should I do this?" They're yelling, "Do it." She did it. They went nuts. Now, Roseanne has reclaimed for female comedy the phallic aggression, which is traditionally associated with male humor, whose totem, fool's scepter, is actually the penis. Even Roseanne's physical posture, she has discarded the apologetic feminine stance on stage and plants her feet firmly apart, suggests phallic power, which, she insists, is really womb power that men stole. "A man standing with his legs apart is impersonating a woman," Roseanne explains, assuming the erect birth posture. "Men all have womb envy. We don't have penis envy." Too much. "My psychic penis is way larger than any man's. My attitude is, I have a vagina, and therefore I have a bigger penis." Roseanne stated her position most succinctly in her rough-and-tumble stand-up days, when she says, "I was the filthiest act ever. I would do anything." She'd end her set by saying, "People say to me, you're not very feminine. Well, they can suck my d-." Now, the point of that is that that's as bad as it gets, folks. The point of it is that invariably, in taking those kind of liberties, great comedy always somehow gets back to the phallic. In our time, because of the nature of how we have to live in communities, the political correct climate that we're in, we have to repress an enormous amount of stuff. Our violent and aggressive feelings must be repressed, but we pay a lot of money to people who will express our infantile impulses for us. I wrote this book about Barry Humphries from backstage, and I think it's the only book that's ever been written about a performer from backstage. And it was extremely interesting because Humphries packs 2,000 people a night into a room, and when they laugh, it's like watching seaweed underwater. People are just laughing in unison, moving forward and backward. But what was extraordinary to watch when he would do his incredibly aggressive and jokes was that people laughed. You could see people laughing like this. Their hands were over their mouths as if he were calling out some dark secret. They would laugh like this and then look at each other as if to say, "Was it good for you?" Very interesting. But the daring of these comedians, like Roseanne, like Barry, and the generosity link these contemporaries to the tradition of the great clowns, who were and are exercises in being, not impersonation. In every role, the clown, the great early clowns, is always himself, spontaneous, kinetic, resourceful, an essence, unexplained but articulate, with his own unique vocabulary of sound and movement on the borderline somehow between dream and reality. Those clowns, my father and that ilk, were called low comedians. You've all heard the phrase. But what's so fascinating about the low comedians, who were disdained by the highbrow press, is that they became the paradigms for the next generation's high theatrical art. For instance, if those of you the playwrights of the modern canon, and I'm talking about Brecht, Meyerhold, Beckett, all the great avant-gardists looking for a way of approaching and creating dangerous and prophetic and poetic theater, turn to the clowns. You hear all talk about Brecht. and the epic actor. Who was his favorite epic actor? The epitome of it? Charlie Chaplin. When he sought to develop an idea of his alienation effect, as it were, the famous style, he got it. He got the first inkling of it from a music hall comedian called Valentin, who told him when he asked how to close, he gave him the clue to the artificiality, because he asked Valentin, how do soldiers go into war? And Valentin said, they're white with fear. And so he painted them white with fear. Artaud's Theater of Cruelty, I'm sure you've heard that bandied about. What was that? What it was, it turns out, the Marx Brothers. Here's Artaud writing about animal crackers. These events, this is what the Theater of Cruelty was, these events comprise a kind of intellectual freedom in which the unconscious of each of the characters, repressed by conventions and habits, avenges itself and us at the same time. Avenges itself and us, talking about revenge. Meyerhold, the great Russian director in rebellion against the naturalism of Stanislavski and static theater, talks about the cabotin, the juggler, and he writes terrifically, "The mime stops the mouth of the rhetorician, who belongs not on the stage but in the pulpit. The juggler reveals the total self-sufficiency of the actor's skills with the expressiveness of his gestures and the language of his movement. In contemporary theater, the comedian has been replaced by the educated reader. The play will be read in costume and makeup," might as well be the announcement in playbills today. And finally, and perhaps most persuasively, our greatest modern dramatist, Samuel Beckett, took his entire inspiration from the clowns, Keaton, Laurel, and Hardy. It's interesting that Keaton played and performed in Beckett's first movie called Film, and my father debuted Waiting for Godot on Broadway in 1954. But what Beckett did was, where the clowns turned, where the clowns' meaning was action, Beckett turned their action and deconstructed it to give it a kind of intellectual meaning. And there's a very, when Buster Keaton was making the film, called Film, he suggested some business to Beckett. And the director of the film writes in his biography, Alan Schneider, about this. He suggested, Keaton suggested some special business with his walk, or perhaps that bit where he could keep sharpening a pencil and it would get smaller and smaller. I said, we didn't normally pad Beckett's material. The irony, of course, is that Beckett's material was Keaton. Now, as I said at the beginning, comedy always is refracting our moment. And when you get a shift in the society, if you want to find that shift, if you want to winkle it out, you will hear it in the laughter and in the kind of laughter. And it seems to me that after World War II, there was a sort of a real mutation of consciousness in American life. In the 10 years from 1944 to 54, America per capita income tripled, and it was the greatest growth in wealth in the history of Western civilization. That, coupled with coming off a decade of depression and then 5 years of war, had an amazing mutating effect on the American imagination, a sort of a movement inward from external to internal, from social change to personal fulfillment, from social realism to abstract expressionism, from Marxism to Freudianism, from naturalism to the personal lyricism of Tennessee Williams. And the instead of creating myths of hope, there was, in the sense of windedness, a sense of elegant dread and emotional paralysis. And comedy changed to reflect that. And the term that we now use for a lot of the comedy that we have, what we call as comedy, reflects this paralysis and this stasis. We call it stand up. There is no movement. It is frozen in time, in place, a talking head. Now, the personification of this seems to me to be Woody Allen.
And Ian Allen, who I've written about in The New Yorker and who I'm friendly with, it seems to me that the pratfall has been replaced by the shrug. Here's an Allen joke that I want to parse with you. How can I find meaning in a finite universe given my shirt and waist size? Now these jokes work on like an algebraic equation, A plus B equals C. So how can I find meaning in a finite universe raises the hope of some sort of philosophical payoff, right? Finite universe. Sounds like philosophy to me, is it? I don't know. Anyway, and what happens is if you track the joke, given my shirt and waist size, completely flunks the issue. It brings it back to him. There are no answers. He just shrugs it off. That's the joke. Here's an Orton joke. With madness, as with vomit, A plus B, you wait to see how it will factor out, and the joke is in the C. With madness, as with vomit, it is the passerby who receives the inconvenience. Now, any of you who've had mad friends know that's not true. You're really inconvenienced. But the reality is that it engages you, it makes you think, it tests your notions of reality. And it's provoking. With Allen, it seems to me, the charm of action has been replaced by the charm of agony. Here's a joke. Allen's joke. Dostoevsky, Camus, Kierkegaard, Berdyaev, the minds I consider romantic. I guess I equate dread with romance, which is why I'm not invited to more parties. In Manhattan, when he lists his reasons to live, he lists the following: Satchmo, Willie Mays, Potato Head Blues, Flaubert's Sentimental Education. His reasons to live are all secondhand. They're all vicarious, where the old guard brought the streets onto the stage. Woody brings his reading. And where, this is very strange to me, where the clowns took a death-dealing world and gave it a sense of life, Allen takes life and gives it a sense of death. You'll recall in Annie Hall him handing Diane Keaton a denial of death, as if angst could be boned up on. Now, my point here is this generates a sort of mood of decline, but in a kind of climate, in a way, of surrender. But courage really wants to laugh, and great laughter, therefore, must always be on the attack. Now, Joe Orton was a playwright. He wasn't a stand-up comedian, but he's the only writer that I know in the contemporary canon who took the clown's impulse and transferred it from the stage to the page. In his notebooks, early before he could certainly deliver this, he wrote, "Cleanse my heart, give me the ability to rage correctly." And for a long time, before he was self-educated, before he actually could write, he used to deface, this is very interesting given where I'm giving this talk, he used to deface public library books and put false blurbs on the side, and in picture books sometimes put, you know, in the Three Faces of Eve, it would be a monkey, a cat, and a woman, you know. He would hide behind the carols to watch to see if people would be distressed. He wanted them to be disturbed and shocked, and he wanted to see the shock. He wanted to see their carapace of bourgeois sentiment cracked in some way. Now, you would be right to think that this was infantile, and you'll be glad to know that he and his fella went to jail for 6 months for defacing public library books. However, if you think that one of the sort of ironies of this is, if you want to go to London and see these books, you can see them in the Holloway Road Library, but a guard will stand by you and watch you read them because they're extremely valuable. But what Orton was trying to do, and I'm winding up here, but I want to just flesh it out for you. He wanted, he said, to create a seismic disturbance. And he wrote in his notebooks this. See, it's not a fantasy. This is the comic instinct. Words were more effective than actions. In the right hands, verbs and nouns could create panic. The blast of a long sentence was curiously local, and a lot of shorter sentences seemed better. And then there was the problem of gathering enough of the enemy together in order that they might listen. He started wondering where and how he could hit the enemy most. He started calculating and found some sentences were puny against large targets. Then, perhaps a new type of sentence. His figure showed that when a particularly dangerous collection of words exploded, the shockwaves were capable of killing centuries afterwards. He wanted to kill. He wanted to kill attitudes. He wanted to make space for his own sexual proclivities and to sort of eliminate the sort of oppression of being labeled. He wanted to turn, and his way of doing this was to take stereotypes in farce and turn them upside down. And in Orton's farces, you know, conventional farce, it's thought of as a conservative form because at the end of all the mayhem, life returns to the status quo ante, not in Orton. In Orton, after the mayhem, everything has changed for good. In Sloan, entertaining Mr. Sloan, he wanted to smash up the notion of sexual categories, and it's about a brother and a sister sexually pursuing this polymorphous and very perverse young man. Loot, which you may have seen, it was a movie as well as a play. It teased the credulity of the English and the police and the ability or the willingness of the public to bow to all authority. You're at liberty to answer your own doorbell, miss, says the corrupt detective in Loot. That is how we tell whether we live in a free country. And in What the Butler Saw, which is completely hilarious, he literally laughs in the sort of sexual confusions of people scurrying in and out of doors. He laughs sexual categories off the stage. I'm a heterosexual, says one confused player. And the comeback is, I wish you wouldn't use those Chaucerian words. The very first lines of Loot are, wake up, stop dreaming. And that is Orton's whole story. That is the story of all great comedy, which is to essentially disenchant the audience. In Orton's plays, only the credulous are shafted. The person who pays the price is the father of the criminal who is stitched up by his son and sent to prison for a crime he didn't commit. He's Irish, he's Catholic, and he exits with probably the best exit line in the modern English drama. I'm innocent, he cries. What a terrible thing to happen to a man who's been kissed by the Pope. Now, the joke is this. The joke for Orton is, or the message from Orton is, faith is nice, but doubt gets you an education. Now, questioning is not encouraged in commercial American laughter or British laughter. Here's a joke I heard on television, Joan Rivers. The day I have a multiple orgasm, Stevie Wonder will get a hole in one. If you think about it, that is just a meretricious joke. It's terrible because it means absolutely nothing. It's simply a collage of words that shock but lead you to absolutely no idea. Here's Orton. All classes are criminal. We live in an age of equality. It connects with something. It illuminates something. It tests assumptions about life, and it makes unacceptable ideas irresistible. In our culture, especially, we suffer from the sort of a Puritan squeamishness. I mean, you see it in it. Words like sensational, grotesque, cruel are used usually and critically in pejorative terms. But my point is that cruelty, aggression, revenge are crucial to great comedy. Without a killing, no feast. Clowns add disorder to our sense of order and give us the intimation of a whole. And I think they teach two important things. First, that it's not necessarily to do political theater. But it's important to do theater politically. And lastly, I think that they are a wonderful model for artistic endeavor, and even, dare I say it, for criticism, because they teach the importance of corrupting an audience with pleasure. Thank you very much.
Drama critic, author, and playwright John Lahr on Comedy and Revenge. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 and includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Tim Skog with help from John Perotti. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. Special thanks to Bill Galluli for help with tonight's program. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us. This is